Chapter 28. News in a Cloth Sack. The morning after Matt promised to help Teslin, if he could, and Jolene and this Edesina he had yet to lay eyes on, Tylin announced that she was departing the city. "Surath is going to show me how much of Altara I control now, Pigeon," she said. Her belt knife was stuck in the carved bedpost, and they were still lying on the rumpled linen sheets amid a tangle of bedding, him in only the silk scarf that hid the hanging scar around his neck, and her in her skin. A very fine skin it was, too, as smooth as he had ever touched. Idly she traced his other scars with a long, green-lacquered fingernail. One way and another he had acquired quite a few, though not for want of trying to avoid them. His hide would not bring much at auction, that was for sure, but the scars fascinated her. "It wasn't her idea, actually. Tuon thinks it will help me if I see with my own eyes instead of just on a map. And what that girl suggests, Surath does. She would like to see it done yesterday, though. We'll be going by Tauraken, so to cover the ground quickly. As much as 200 miles in a day, it seems. Oh, don't look sick, piglet. I won't make you climb on one of those things." Matt heaved a sigh of relief. It had not been the prospect of flying that upset him. He thought he might actually like that. But if he was out of Ebu Dar for any length of time, the light alone knew whether Teslin or Jolene, or even this Edesina, might grow impatient enough to do something stupid, or what idiocy Beslin might get up to. Beslin worried him almost as much as the women. Tylin, excited by her coming flight on one of those Shan Shan beasts, looked more an eagle than ever. "I'll be gone little more than a week, sweetling, That green fingernail traced the foot-long puckering that slanted across his ribs. "Shall I tie you to the bed so I'll know you'll be safe till I return?" Returning her wicked smile with his most winning grin took a bit of effort. He was fairly sure she was joking, but only fairly. The clothes she chose today put him all in red, brilliant enough to hurt the eye. All red, except for the flowers, worked on the coat and the cloak anyway, and his black hat and scarf. The white lace at his neck and wrists only made the rest look redder. Still, he scrambled into them, eager to get out of her apartments. With Tylin, a man was wise not to be too sure of anything. She might not be joking, too. Tylin had not exaggerated Surath's impatience, it appeared. In little more than 2 hours by the jeweled cylinder clock in Tylin's sitting room, a gift from Surath, he was accompanying the queen to the docks. Well, Surath and Tylin rode at the head of the 20 or so other blood that were to accompany them, and their assorted sojin, men and women who bowed their half-shaved heads to the blood and stared down their noses at everyone else, while he rode behind on pips. An Altaran queen's pretty could not ride with the blood, which included Tylin herself now, of course. It was not as if he was a hereditary servant or anything of that level. The blood and most of the sojin were mounted on fine animals, sleek mares with arched necks and a delicate step, deep-chested geldings with fierce eyes and strong withers. His luck seemed to have no effect on horse-racing, but he would have wagered on pips against any of them. The blunt-nosed bay gelding was not showy, but Matt was sure he could outrun nearly all of those pretty animals in a sprint, and all of them over a long haul. After so long in the stables, Pips wanted to frisk if he could not run, and it took all Matt's skill, well, all the skill that had somehow come with those other men's memories, to keep the animal in hand. Before they were halfway to the docks, though, his leg was aching to the hip. If he was to leave Ebu Dar any time soon, it would have to be by sea or with Luca's show. He had a good notion how to make the man leave before spring, if it came to that. A dangerous notion, maybe, but he did not see much choice. The alternative was riskier still. He was not alone at the rear. More than 50 men and women, blessedly wearing thick white woolen robes over the sheer garments they usually went around in, marched behind him in two rows, some leading pack horses with large wicker hampers full of delicacies. The blood could not do without their servants, In fact, they seemed to think they would be sleeping rough with so few. The D'Acquaville seldom raised their eyes from the paving stones, and their faces were meek as milk. He had seen a D'Acquaville sent for a strapping once, a yellow-haired man about his age, and the fellow had raced to bring the instrument of his own punishment. He had not even tried to delay or hide, much less escape the strapping. Matt could not understand people like that. Ahead of him rode six Suldam, their short divided skirts showing their ankles. Very nice ankles on one or two, but the women sat their saddles as if they were of the blood too. The cowls of their lightning-paneled cloaks hung down their backs, and they let the cold gusts lift the cloaks as though the chill did not touch them, or would not dare. Two had leashed Amani walking beside their horses. Matt studied the women surreptitiously. One of the Damani, a short woman with pale blue eyes, was linked by a silvery eyedom to the plump olive-skinned Suldam he had seen walking Teslin. The dark-haired Damani answered to the name Pura. The Aes Sedai agelessness was clear on her smooth face. He had not really believed Teslin when she said the woman had become a true Damani, but the graying Suldam leaned low in her saddle to say something to the woman who had been Rima Galfrey, and whatever it was the Suldam murmured, Pura laughed and clapped her hands in delight. Matt shivered. She would bloody well shout for help if he tried to take the eyedom from her neck. Light, what was he thinking of? Bad enough that he was stuck with pulling three Aes Sedai's bacon off the fire for them. Burn him, but he did seem to get lumbered with doing that every time he bloody turned around. Bad enough that, without thinking about trying to get any more out of Ebu Dar. Ebu Dar was a great seaport, with perhaps the largest harbor in the known world, and the docks were long gray fingers of stone thrusting out from the quay that ran the whole length of the city. Almost all the mooring spots were taken by Shonchan vessels of every size, the crews in the rigging and cheering vigorously as Suroth passed by, a thunder of voices calling her name. The men on other ships waved their arms and shouted as well, though many appeared confused as to who or what they were cheering. No doubt they thought it expected of them. On those vessels the wind blowing across the harbor stirred the golden bees of Ilion, and the crescent moons of Tyr, and the golden hawk of Mayen. Apparently, Rand had not ordered the merchants there to stop trading with Shonchan-held ports, or else the merchants were going behind his back. Colors flashed through Matt's skull, and he shook his head to clear it. Most merchants would trade their mother's murderer if it brought profit. The southernmost dock had been cleared of ships, and Shonchan officers with thin plumes on their lacquered helmets stood waiting to hand Suroth and Talon down into one of the large rowboats that stood waiting, eight men on the long oars of each. After Talon gave Matt a last kiss anyway, almost yanking his hair out to pull his head down, and after she pinched his bottom as though no one was bloody watching. Suroth frowned impatiently until Talon was settled in the longboat, and in truth the Shonchan woman did not stop chafing even then, twitching her fingers at Alwyn, her sojin, so the sharp-faced woman was continually scrambling across the benches to fetch her one thing or another. The rest of the blood received deep bows from the officers, but had to climb down the ladders with their sojin's aid. The Suldam helped the Damani into the boats, and no one at all helped the white-robed folk load the pack-hampers and themselves. Soon enough, the boats were crossing the harbor toward where the Rakan and Torakan were kept south of the Rahad, spidering through the sprawling anchored fleet of Shonchan ships and the scores of captured seafolk vessels that dotted the harbor. The greater number of those appeared to have been re-rigged with ribbed Shonchan sails and different lines. Their crews were Shonchan, too. Excepting the windfinders he tried not to think about, and maybe some who had been sold, the surviving Atha'an Mier, were all in the Rahad with the other D'Acquaville clearing the silted-up canals. And there was nothing he could do about it. He did not owe them anything. He had more on his plate than he could handle already. And there was nothing he could do. That was all there was to it. He wanted to ride away immediately, to leave the seafolk ships behind him. No one on the docks paid him the slightest heed. The officers had gone away as soon as the boats cast off. Someone, he did not know who, had taken the pack horses away. The seamen climbed out of the rigging and went back to their work, and the members of the Cargo Loaders Guild began pushing their low, heavy barrows, stacked with bales and crates and barrels. But if he left too soon, Talon might decide he was planning to keep riding right out of the city and send for him. So he sat Pips on the end of the dock and waved like a bull-goose fool till she was far enough away that she could not see him without a looking-glass. Despite the throbbing leg, he rode slowly back up almost the whole length of the quay. He avoided looking at the harbor again. Soberly dressed merchants stood watching their cargo being loaded or unloaded, sometimes slipping a purse to a man or woman in a green leather vest to obtain gentler handling for their goods or more speed, not that it seemed possible the guild folk could move any faster. Southerners always seemed to move at a half-trot unless the sun was right overhead, when the heat here could roast a duck. And with a gray sky and a cutting wind off the sea, it would have been cold no matter where the sun stood. By the time he was abreast of the Mulhara, he had counted more than 20 Suldam patrolling the docks with Damani, poking their noses into boats, leaving anchored ships that were not Shonshan, boarding any vessel newly arrived at the docks, or, for that matter, ready to cast off lines. He had been quite sure they would be there. It was going to have to be Valen Luka. The only alternative was just too hazardous, except in an emergency. Luka was chancy too, but the only real choice left. Back at the Tarasin Palace, he climbed down off Pips with a wince and pulled his walking staff out from behind the saddle girth. Letting a groom take the bay, he limped inside, his left leg barely able to support his weight. Maybe a soak in a hot bath would take some of the pain. Maybe then he could think. Luka had to be caught by surprise, but before it came to Luka, there were a few other little problems to overcome.
"Ah, there you are,"
Noel said, popping up in front of him. Matt had caught only glimpses of the old man since getting him abed, but he looked well-rested in his freshly brushed gray coat, considering that he vanished into the city every day and only returned to the palace at night. Adjusting the bits of lace at his cuffs, he smiled confidingly, revealing the gaps in his teeth.
"You are planning something, Lord Matt, and I would like to offer my services."
"I'm planning to take the weight off my leg," Matt said as casually as he could. Noel seemed harmless enough. According to Harnan, he told stories before going to sleep, stories that Harnan and the other Red Arms seemed to swallow whole, even the one about some place called Shibuya, supposedly beyond the Aiel Waste, where women who could channel had tattooed faces, over 300 crimes carried a penalty of death, and giants lived under the mountains, men taller than Ogier, with their faces on their bellies. He claimed to have been there. No one who made claims like that could be anything but harmless. On the other hand, the one time Matt had seen him handle those long daggers he carried under his coat, he had looked far from harmless. There was a way a man had of touching a weapon that said he was accustomed to using it. "If I decide to plan anything else, I'll keep you in mind." Still smiling, Noel tapped one of those crooked fingers against the side of his beak of a nose.
"You don't trust me yet. That is understandable. Although if I meant you any harm, all I had to do was stand back that night in the alley. You have the look in your eye. I've seen great men laying plans, and villains dark as the pit of doom, too. There is a look a man gets laying dangerous plans he doesn't want known."
"My eyes are just tired," Matt laughed, leaning on his staff. "Great men laying plans? The old fellow had probably seen them in Shibuya with the giants. I do thank you for that alley, you know. If there's ever anything more I can do for you, ask. But right now, I'm going to find a hot bath."
"Does this golem drink blood?"
Noel asked, catching Matt's arm as he started to hobble by. Light he wished he had not mentioned that name where the old man could hear. He wished Brigida had never told him about the thing. "Why do you ask?" "Golem lived on blood. They ate nothing else."
"There was another man found with his throat torn out last night. Only there was almost no blood on him or his bedding. Did I mention? He was at an inn down near the Muldeen Gate. If that thing did leave the city, it's back.
Glancing beyond Matt, he made a low, elaborate bow to someone.
If you change your mind, I'm always ready,
he said in a lower voice when he straightened. Matt looked over his shoulder as the old man hurried off. Tuan was standing beneath one of the gilded stand lamps, watching him through her veil. Looking at him, at least. Glancing? As always, the moment he saw her, she turned away and glided off down the hall, her pleated white skirts rustling faintly. There was no one with her today. For the second time that day, Matt shivered. A pity the girl had not gone with Suroth and Tylan. A man given a loaf should not complain that a few crumbs were missing, but Aes Sedai and Seanchan, golems stalking him and old men poking their noses in, and skinny girls staring at him was enough to give any man the gollywogs. Maybe he should forget about wasting time soaking his leg. He felt better once he had sent Lopin to fetch the rest of his own clothes from Beslin's toy cupboard, and Naram to find Julin. His leg still hurt like fire and wobbled when he wanted to walk, but if he was not going to waste time, then he might as well get a move on about it. He wanted to be gone from Ebudar before Tylan came back, and that gave him 10 days, less to be on the safe side. When the thief catcher stuck his head in at the bedroom door, Matt was studying himself in Tylan's tall stand mirror. The red garments were tucked away in the wardrobe with the rest of the gauds she had given him. Maybe Tylan's next pretty could get some use of them. The coat he had put on was the plainest he owned, a fine-woven blue wool without a thread of embroidery. The sort of coat a man could be proud to wear, without having everybody stare at him. A decent coat. Maybe a little lace, he muttered, fingering the neck of his shirt. Just a little. It really was a very plain coat, come to think. Almost sober.
I don't know anything about lace, Julin said. Is that why you wanted me?
No, of course not. What are you grinning at? The fellow was not just grinning. His smile nearly split his dark face in two.
I am happy, that's all. Suroth is gone, and I am happy. If you don't want to ask me about lace, what do you want?
Blood and bloody ashes. The woman he was interested in must be one of Suroth's Dacovale. One she had left behind. He certainly had no other reason to care whether she was gone, much less be happy over it. And the man wanted to take one of her property. Well, maybe that was not so much, compared to taking a couple of Damani. Limping over to put an arm around Julin's shoulders, Matt walked him out into the sitting room. I need a Damani dress to fit a woman about so high. He held up a hand at just about his shoulder. And slender. He gave the fellow his most sincere smile, but Julin's own smile faded markedly. I need 3 Suldam dresses, too, and an Idam. And it came to me that the man who knows best how to steal something without getting caught would be a thief catcher.
I am a thief catcher, the man growled, shaking off Matt's arm. Not a thief.
Matt let his own grin vanish.
Julin, you know the only way to take those sisters out of the city is if the guards think they're still Damani. Teslin and Edesina are wearing what they need, but we have to disguise Jolene. Suroth will be back in 10 days, Julin. If we aren't gone by then, in all likelihood your pretty will still be her property when we go.
He could not help feeling that if they were not gone by then, none of them would be going. Light a man could shiver himself to death indoors in this city. Stuffing his fists into the pockets of his dark tyrant coat, Julin glared at him. Glared through him, really, at something the thief catcher did not like. Finally, he grimaced and muttered,
It won't be easy.
The days that followed were anything but easy. The serving women clucked and laughed over his new clothes. His old clothes, that was. They grinned and made wagers where he could hear over how fast he could change back when Tylan returned. Most seemed to think he would race through the halls ripping off whatever he was wearing as soon as he heard she was on her way, but he paid them no mind. Except for the part about Tylan returning. The first time a serving woman mentioned it, he nearly jumped out of his skin, thinking she actually had for some reason. A number of the women, and nearly all the men, took his change of clothing to mean he was leaving. Running away, they called it disapprovingly, and did what they could to hamper him. In their eyes, he was the ointment to soothe Tylan's aching tooth, and they did not want her to come back and bite them for losing it. If he had not made sure Lopin or Nerim was always in Tylan's apartments, guarding his belongings, the clothes would have vanished again, and only Vannin and the Red Arms kept Pips from disappearing out the stables. Matt tried to encourage the belief. When he went and Tudemani vanished at the same time, the events were sure to be linked. But with Tylan gone, and his intention to run away plain before she returned, she would be safe from blame. Every day, even when it rained, he rode Pips in circles in the stable, for a longer time every day, as if trying to build up his stamina. Which he actually was, he realized after a while. His leg and hip still ached like fury, but he began to think he could manage as much as 10 miles before needing to climb down. 8 miles, anyway. Often, if the sky was clear, Suldam were walking Damani when he exercised. The Shonchan women were aware he was not Thailand's property, but on the other hand, he heard some call him her toy. Thailand's toy, they said, as if that was his name. He was not important enough for them to learn if he had another. To them, someone was either Dako Vale or not, and this halfway business amused them no end. He rode to the sound of Suldam laughing and tried to tell himself it was all to the good. The more people who could tell that he worked to flee before Tylan returned, the better for her. It just was not very pleasant for him. Now and then he saw Aes Sedai faces among the Damani being walked, 3 besides Teslin, but he had not a clue what Edesina looked like. She could have been the short pale woman who reminded him of Moraine, or the tall one with silvery golden hair, or the slender black-haired woman. Gliding along beside Suldam, any of them might have been taking a walk on her own, if not for the gleaming collar around her neck and the leash tying her to the Suldam's wrist. Teslin herself looked increasingly grim every time he saw her, staring fixedly straight ahead. Every time there seemed to be more determination on her face, and something that might have been panic, too. He began to worry about her, and her impatience. He wanted to reassure Teslin. He did not need those old memories to tell him that determination combined with panic could get people killed, but they confirmed it. He wanted to reassure her, only he dared not go near the kennels in the attic again. Tuan continued to be there when he turned around, looking at him or glancing or whatever she was doing, just too often for comfort. Not enough to make him think she was following him. Why would she do that? Just too often. Occasionally, her sojin, Seleucia, was with her, and now and then Anoth, though the strange tall woman seemed to vanish from the palace after a time, at least from the hallways. She was on retreat, he heard, whatever that was supposed to mean, and he only wished she had taken Tuan with her. He doubted the girl would believe he was taking sweets to a windfinder a second time. Maybe she still wanted to buy him? If that was the case, he still could not understand why. He had never been able to understand what attracted women to a man. They seemed to go pop-eyed over the most ordinary-looking fellows. But he knew he was no beauty, no matter what Tylan said. Women lied to get a man into bed, and they lied worse once they had him there. In any case, Tuan was a minor irritant, a fly on his ear, no more than that. It took more than chattering women or staring girls to make him sweat. Absent as she was, however, Tylan did. If she came back and caught him preparing to leave, she might change her mind about selling. She was a high lady herself now, after all, and he was sure she would shave her head to a crest before much longer. A proper Shonchan high blood, and who knew what she would do then? Tylan caused a little sweat, but there was more than enough else to drench a man in it. He continued to hear from Noel about the Golam's murders, and sometimes from Tom. There was a fresh one every night, though no one but those two and him seemed to connect the killings. Matt kept to open places as much as he could, with people around as often as possible. He stopped sleeping in Thailand's bed and never spent 2 nights running in the same place. If that meant a night in a stable loft, well, he had slept in haylofts before, although he did not recall hay sticking through his clothes quite that sharply. Still, better stuck by hay than having his throat torn out. He had sought out Tom straight away after he decided to try freeing Teslin, and had found him in the kitchens chatting with the cooks over a honey-glazed chicken. Tom got on well with cooks, as he did with farmers and merchants and nobles. He had a way of getting on with everyone, did Tom Marilyn, a way of hearing everyone's gossip and fitting it together to make a picture. He could look at things from a slant and see what others missed. As soon as he finished the chicken, Tom had come up with the only way to get the Aes Sedai past the guards. The whole thing had almost seemed easy then, for a very short while, but other obstacles arose. Julin possessed the same sort of twisty way of looking at things, perhaps from his years as thief-catcher, and some nights Matt met with him and Tom in the tiny room the two men shared in the servants' quarters to try planning how to overcome those obstacles. Those were what really made Matt sweat. At the first of those meetings, the night Tylan left, Beslin barged in looking for Tom, so he said. Unfortunately, he had listened at the door first, hearing enough that he could not be foisted off with a story. Very unfortunately, he wanted to take part. He even told them just how to do it. "An uprising," he said, squatting on the three-legged stool between the two narrow beds. A washstand, with a chipped white pitcher and bowl and no mirror, finished crowding the room. Julin sat on the edge of one bed in his shirt sleeves, his face unreadable, and Tom was stretched out on the other, examining his knuckles with a frown. That left Matt to lean against the door to keep anyone else from barging in. He did not know whether to laugh or cry. Plainly, Tom had known about this madness all along. This was what he had been trying to cool down. "The people will rise when I give the word," Beslin went on. "My friends and I have talked to men all over the city. They are ready to fight." Sighing, Matt eased his weight more onto his good leg. He suspected that when Beslin gave the word, he and his friends would rise alone. Most people were more willing to talk about fighting than to do it, especially against soldiers. "Beslin, in Gleeman's tales, grooms with pitchforks and bakers with cobblestones defeat armies because they want to be free." Tom snorted so hard his long white mustaches stirred. Matt ignored him. "In real life, the grooms and the bakers get killed. I know good soldiers when I see them, and the Seanchan are very good. If we free the Damani along with the Aes Sedai, they will fight beside us," Beslin insisted. "There must be 200 or more Damani up in the attic, Beslin, most of them Seanchan. Free them, and like as not, every last one will run to find a Suldam. Like we couldn't even trust all the women who aren't Seanchan." Matt held up a hand to forestall Beslin's protest. "We have no way to find out which we can trust and no time to. And if we did, we'd have to kill the rest. I'm not up to killing a woman whose only crime is that she's on a leash. Are you?" Beslin looked away, but his jaw was set. He was not giving up. "Whether we free any Damani or not," Matt went on, "if the people rise up, the Seanchan will turn Ebu Dar into a slaughter yard. They put down rebellions hard, Beslin. Very hard. We could kill every Damani in the attic, and they would bring in more from the camps. Your mother will come back to find rubble inside the walls and your head stuck up outside them, or hers will soon join it. You don't think they'll believe she did not know what her own son was planning, do you?" Light, did she? The woman was brave enough to try it. He did not think she was stupid enough, but... "She says we are mice," Beslin said bitterly. "When wolfhounds pass by, mice lie quiet or get eaten," he quoted. "I don't like being a mouse, Matt." Matt breathed a little more easily. "Better a live mouse than a dead one, Beslin." Which might not have been the most diplomatic way to put it. Beslin grimaced at him, but it was true. He encouraged Beslin to join the meetings, if just to keep a rein on him, but Beslin seldom came, and it fell to Tom to try to cool the man's ardor when and as he could. The most he could persuade Beslin to promise was that he could not call for the rising until the rest of them had been gone a month to let them get clear. That was something settled, if not satisfactorily. Everything else seemed to take two steps and hit a stone wall, or a tripwire. Julin's lady love had quite a hold on him. For her, he seemed to not mind doffing his tyrant clothes for a servant's green and white livery, or missing sleep to spend two nights sweeping the floor not far from the stairs that led up to the kennels. No one looked twice at a servant pushing a broom, not even the other servants. The Tarasin Palace had enough of those that they did not all know one another, and if they saw a man in livery with a broom, they assumed he was supposed to be using it. Julin spent two whole days sweeping, too, and finally reported that Suldam inspected the kennels first thing in the morning and just after dark, and might be in or out at any time of the day between, but at night the Damani were left to themselves.
I overheard a Suldam say she was glad she wasn't out in the camps where...
Lying stretched out on his thin mattress, Julin paused to yawn copiously behind his hand. Tom was sitting on the edge of his bed, which left the stool for Matt. It was better than standing, if not by much. Most people would be asleep at that hour.
Where she'd have to stand guard some nights, the thief catcher continued when he could speak again. Said she liked being able to let the Damani sleep all night, too, so they were all fresh come sunrise.
So we must move at night, Tom murmured, fingering his long white mustache.
There was no need to add that anything moving at night drew eyes. Seanchan patrolled the streets at night, which the civil guard never had. The guard had been amenable to bribes, too, until the Seanchan disbanded them. Now, at night, it was as likely to be the death watch guards in the street, and anyone who tried to bribe them might not live to face trial.
Have you found an idom yet, Julin? I asked. Or the dresses? Dresses can't be as difficult as an idom.
Julin yawned into his hand again.
I'll get them when I get them. They don't just leave either lying about, you know.
Tom discovered that simply walking Damani through the gates was not possible. Or rather, as he freely admitted, Rizal had discovered it. It seemed that one of the high-ranking officers staying at the Wandering Woman had a singing voice she found most entertaining.
One of the blood can take Damani out with no questions asked, Tom said at their next meeting.
This time, he and Julin both were sitting on their beds. Matt was beginning to hate that stool.
Or few enough, anyway. Suldam, though, need an order signed and sealed by one of the blood, an officer who's captain or above, or a dare Suldam. The guards at the gates and on the docks have lists of every seal in the city that qualifies, so I can't just make any sort of seal and think it will be accepted. I need a copy of the right sort of order with the right sort of seal. That leaves the question of who will be our three Suldam.
Maybe Rizal will be one, Matt suggested.
She did not know what they were doing, and telling her would be a risk. Tom had asked her all sorts of questions, as if he was trying to learn about life under the Seanchan, and she had been happy enough to ask her Seanchan friend, but she might not be happy enough to chance her pretty head going up on a pike. She could do worse than say no.
And what about your lady love, Julin?
He had a thought on the third. He had asked Julin to find a Suldam dress that would fit Satala Anan, though there had been no chance to actually put it to her yet. He'd only been back to the Wandering Woman once, since Jolene had walked into the kitchen, to make sure she understood he was doing all he could. She did not, but Mistress Anan had actually managed to smother the Aes Sedai's anger before she could begin shouting. She would make the perfect Suldam for Jolene. Julin shrugged uncomfortably.
I had a hard enough time convincing Thera to run away with me. She is timid now. I can help her overcome that, in time. I know I can. But I don't think she is up to anything like pretending to be a Suldam.
Tom tugged at his mustaches.
It's unlikely Rizal would leave under any circumstances. It seems she likes Banner General Lord Yamada's singing well enough that she has decided to marry him.
He sighed regretfully.
There will be no more information from that well, I fear.
And no more pillowing his head on her bosom, his expression said.
Well, both of you think on who we can ask, and see if you can lay hands on a copy of those orders.
Tom managed to find the proper inks and paper, and was ready to imitate anyone's hand and seal. He was contemptuous of seals. Anyone with a turnip and a knife could copy those, he said. Writing another man's hand so the man himself would think he had written it was an art. but none of them were able to find a copy of orders with the necessary seal to copy. Like Idom, the Shanchen did not leave orders lying about. Julin seemed to be making no progress with the Idom either. 2 steps forward and a stone wall. And 6 days were gone, just like that. 4 left. To Matt, it felt as if 6 years had passed since Thailand's departure, and 4 hours remained till she came back. On the 7th day, Tom stopped Matt in the hallway as soon as he came in from his ride. Smiling as though making idle conversation, the one-time gleeman pitched his voice low. The servants hurrying past could not have heard more than a murmur.
According to Noel, the Golem killed again last night. The Seekers have been ordered to find the killer, if they have to stop eating or sleeping to do it, though I can't find out who gave the order. Even the fact that they have been ordered to do anything seems to be a secret. They are practically readying the rack and heating their irons already, though.
No matter that Tom's voice was low, Matt looked around to see whether anyone was listening. The only person inside was a stout gray-haired man named Narvin, in livery, but neither hurrying nor carrying anything. Servants as high as Narvin did not carry or hurry. He blinked at the sight of Matt trying to look every direction at once and frowned. Matt wanted to snarl, but instead he grinned as disarmingly as he knew how, and Narvin went off scowling. Matt was sure the fellow had been responsible for the first attempt to remove Pips from the stable.
"Noel told you about the Seekers?" he whispered incredulously, as soon as Narvin was far enough away. Tom waved a lean hand dismissively.
"Of course not. Just about the killing. Though he does seem to hear whispers and know what they mean. A rare talent, that. I wonder whether he really has been to Shara," he mused. "He said he..."
Tom cleared his throat under Matt's glare.
"Well, later for that. I do have other resources than the much-lamented Rizal. Several of them are listeners. Listeners really do seem to hear everything."
"You've been talking to listeners?"
Matt's voice squeaked like a rusty hinge. He thought his throat might have rusted solid.
"There's nothing to it, as long as they don't know you know," Tom chuckled. "Matt, with Shanchen, you have to assume they are all listeners. That way you learn what you want to know without saying the wrong thing in the wrong ear."
He coughed and knuckled his mustache, not quite hiding a smile, so self-deprecating it all but invited praise.
"I just happen to know 2 or 3 who really are. In any case, more information never hurts. You do want to be gone before Talon returns, don't you? You seem to be looking a little forlorn with her gone."
Matt could only groan. That night, the Golem struck again. Lopin and Naram were bubbling over with the news before Matt had finished his breakfast fish. The whole city was in an uproar, they claimed. The latest victim, a woman, had been discovered at the mouth of an alley, and suddenly people were talking, putting together one killing with another. There was a madman on the loose, and the people were demanding more Shanchen patrols in the streets at night. Matt pushed his plate away, all hunger gone. More patrols. And if that were not bad enough, Surath might come back early if she learned of this, bringing Thailand with her. At best, he could only count on 2 more days. He thought he might lose what he'd already eaten. He spent the rest of the morning pacing, well, limping, up and down the carpet in Thailand's bedchamber, ignoring the pain in his leg while he tried to think of something, anything, that would let him carry out the impossible in 2 days. The pain really was less. He had given up the walking stick, pushing himself to regain strength. He thought he might manage 2 or 3 miles on foot without needing to rest the leg. Without resting it very much, anyway. At midday, Julin brought him the only really good news he had heard in an age. It was not news, exactly. It was a cloth sack containing 2 dresses wrapped around the silver length of an Idom.